pass the meeting over to my first speaker meeting, and my first speaker, who is Al, with 2 years.
I'm Elle, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Elle.
I thought before I came here, I was going to be so clever. I was like, I'm going to get a facial, I'm going to just like do my hair, and just like, they're going to see me and be like, this girl is so AA. This is Miss AA. Well, you got to look, I don't look the way I thought I would. But the good news is I don't look anything near what I looked like when I first came in here. So no matter on my worst day when I wake up from bed, I still look 1,000 times better than I was when I walked through these doors and before I walked through these doors. And also I think that's the universe is laughing at me. Like, ah, you made plans. How cute. Psych! So when I got in here, I was a hot mess. I started drinking and using when I was 13 years old. I believe there's no reason that I started drinking and using, but I had 1,000 excuses, just no real reason. I came from an alcoholic home, so it was somewhat of a learned behavior and somewhat of just a way to be a little different and a little rebellious. I'm originally from Huntington Beach, so 714 represent. So I started drinking when I was about 13. There's a lot of domestic violence, so that was my way of escaping. I ended up in a foster home when I was about 16, and my main care provider was my mom, but I also had my dad in my life. I didn't stay with my dad because we were really, really poor. Like, no hot water, no electricity, on campers, on the side of the street. Of course, as a 15-year-old, I'm like, oh, dude, I'm in, like, ninth grade. Like, I already don't fit in. Nobody fits in ninth grade. So I thought that I had another reason to drink and use. So that's what I did. I had friends. And when I was about 17, I got released from the foster system. And I went to live with my uncle in Bakersfield. And that was the first time I had somebody in my life who was actually really paying attention and really set ground rules. There was only 3 ground rules, but that was a lot more than I was used to. Pretty intense, okay? Didn't know if I could do it. But it was just, don't get arrested, don't drink and use in the house, and don't bring bad company over. So as an alcoholic, of course, I broke all those rules. And my particular favorite job was, I'm going to drink and use in the house. Absolutely not necessary, but I'm doing it anyways, just to be a little different. And around that time, living with my uncle, he was a really strong Christian. He's really, my family has a lot of fanatical people. We hit the jackpot on eccentrics. So we got tons of different people in our family. And so he was a really, really fanatical Christian. And I think absolutely God can work through anyone at any time, because even though he was like super, super eccentric, I still saw something really good there. You know, he wasn't a bad person. You know, he was a pretty good guy. And so I liked what he had. So I did what he did, and I converted to Christianity. But as an alcoholic and an addict, I do everything to the extreme. So if it's my thing, it's absolutely my thing, to the T. So it started off like my disease, very gradual. It's a progressive disease that I carry with me at all times in my body. So it started off, you know, like, hey, I'm a Christian, look at me, I'm doing good, blah, blah. And then at 17, I became a severe Bible-thumping Christian. So I was, like, trying to save everybody. And the good thing is I wasn't drinking and using, but I switched scotch to brandy to make myself feel better. So I absolutely, at all times, even at such a young age of 17, I am always looking for something to make me feel different and just fill that void. And if it comes to hard work and it comes to character building, I will do everything I can to not do that. I take the easy way out on everything. And this was just a new outside, something outside myself to make myself feel different. So I became super fanatical. I was like trying to save you, I was trying to save your dog, I was trying to save your neighbors, and if you weren't accepting, then I'm sorry. we can't have anything to do with you, you're going to hell. But look me up when you're ready, okay? And this has nothing to do with me being better than you. Right. So after a while, I want to say this is the first real time, except when I was in the foster system and my family was looking at my behavior and they didn't want anything to do with me. This was the first real time that I was completely alone. I was absolutely isolated because of my own behavior. I didn't have friends at this point. I was pushing my will. I was driven by 1,000 forms of delusion and ego. And absolutely nobody wanted to be around me. And like a good alcoholic addict, that was okay with me. I still had about 6 more months of misery before I actually realized this. But at some point I did. And I was like, you know what, I have nobody around me. So my pendulum swings really far to the left, and it'll swing really far to the right. And I was done, so I went the opposite direction, and now I am going to be an 18-year-old who's traveling across the country. I have money in my bank account, and I'm just going to really party it up, right? So that's not actually what I was going to do. What I was going to do was explore. I was sightseeing the U.S. Again, a bunch of denial. But yeah, I was sightseeing. So bought a bunch of gear from REI and put all my worldly possessions in it, decided to go across country. And just like my disease and everything else, it's progressive. So it started off just fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But by the end, about 2 years into this traveling, I wasn't just a young college kid traveling the country, taking some time off. I was drinking every single day with people on corners, parks, parks. this is free American soil for me to just be a hobo at. It's just that incomprehensible demoralization. And for me, it didn't come overnight. It wasn't just night and day. It just progressively happened. I started drinking and smoking to get away, to feel comfortable in new situations, to feel a part of. And then when I realized that you guys suck, and I'm much better, absolutely, I started drinking alone. And then that's how it, after 2 years, I ended up in the, I want to call it the Skid Row of Humboldt. I don't know, it's kind of a funny term, but, and I was surrounded, I was drinking, using every single day, and I was surrounded by people I absolutely hated, because I love seeking lower companionship, especially when I know my look good is not looking good anymore, and I'm not fooling anyone. So now I'm just seeking lower companionship, and I'm hanging around with just a bunch of other alcoholics and addicts, you know? Any way to make myself feel better, I would. So, I'd be like, I have all my teeth. You don't. Ha-ha. so much better. it was really sad. It was a poor place to be. So during that time, I was about 20 years old. I was completely in my addiction and disease. I lived to use, I lived to drink, and I drank to live. It was 24/7, that's all I wanted to do, and that's all I thought would make me feel better and fit in. So I started getting arrested a lot, right? I have no idea why. I was innocent every single time. That was a joke, I'm sorry. I was being arrested a lot, and eventually they told me that I was going to be locked up for 3 years. And they said, we don't want you in and out, and we're going to put you in a mental institution because you are so far gone. At that point, I think I was in a drug and alcohol psychosis. So I thought all these crazy things. I thought the Kardashians were after me all the time. I thought it's not original, but I thought the FBI was after me too. And I just, every time I was arrested, I thought they were going to sell me overseas like in the movie Taken. I was just so sure. So I was a mess, you know. I had absolutely no one who wanted me around. So they said, we don't really want you in this county, but we'll keep you. I mean, if you don't have anywhere else to go, we'll absolutely keep you. We're going to keep you here for 3 years. Do you have anybody you can call who will come and take you? And as a good alcoholic, I said, absolutely. And I called it my enabler. So I have a really good dad. I didn't get into that, but he's a good dad. We were poor. So I called him up and said, hey, Dad, I have nowhere to go. These nuts are going to lock me up for 3 years. I think the Kardashians are behind it. I don't know, really. just a suspicion. And he said, absolutely, you can move home. We don't live in Huntington Beach anymore. We live in Visalia. So I came to Visalia. Said, at that point, I had absolutely no options. So I decided to go to Visalia and move with them. And that was the beginning of my, that wasn't the beginning of my incomprehensible demoralization, but it was the beginning of my powerlessness. That's absolutely when I hit rock bottom. I was sleeping, I couldn't sleep on the property, so I got put up in some motel, and I stayed there. And what they told my dad was that she doesn't have a drug and alcohol problem, or I'm sorry, she doesn't have a mental problem, she has a drug and alcohol problem. And at that point, I didn't know what I had. I was just so desperate. I just absolutely wanted to change. I just wanted something different. And that was the first time God really did for me what I couldn't do for myself, being in that motel. Because before that, I was sleeping on the street. I was sleeping under bridges. I was a mess, you know. I was starting fights, and I was being jumped, and I was being kicked out of every bar. I was 188 off of everywhere in Humboldt, which Humboldt's a pretty nice place. So to get kicked out of Humboldt's like kind of questionable. But so that was right when I got into program. I went to my first meeting at a Visalia Young People's meeting, and I really thought I had it all together. I walked in, and I thought I made perfect sense. I thought I looked great. And when I hear stories now, they're like, you're a lunatic. Like, nobody knew what you were saying. I was like, right, you didn't. But apparently that's true. So I got into action right away because I was so desperate, and I just didn't know what else to do. I had no brain cells left. The only brain cells I knew was just take direction and take orders. If you would have said, get on all fours and bark like a dog, I would have. Just because I wanted to keep coming back. That first meeting, they said pick a sponsor, so I did. I picked Mandy. I didn't know how to pick a sponsor, so I just said, who's the prettiest, most popular woman in this room right now? And that's exactly what happened, and that was God doing for me, again, what I couldn't do for myself, because she was amazing. I had the privilege of working with her and growing so much my first year. So what I did was, even though I had no idea what I was doing, I used my phone list, and I called someone every single day. I just got on that phone because I would wake up confused. I didn't know how to function sober. So I'd get on the phone and be like, oh my gosh, my roommate looked at me weird today. Like, how do I handle this? There's a knife in the kitchen. Do I get it? I mean, I don't know, you know? I'm just so blessed that I kept coming back, so I gotta not be the psycho person I was when that first 6 months. So they said get a phone list and go to a meeting. So I went to 3 meetings a day, and that was really when I got to just meet people. I just gotta just interact and see people doing things a little different. And then they said find a higher power. So I was pretty uncomfortable with that idea, But again, I was so desperate that I mean, like, a higher power is not the worst thing in the world, right? So I got a higher power, and then I want to say that first year was so exciting, and I just did so many amazing things, and I just really was so creative and inventive, but that's not what happened. I just kept doing the basics over and over and over. I'm really nervous too, so if I'm not making sense, I'm sorry. But I just suited up and showed up every single day, and I would go, they'd go out to eat, and I'd be like, okay, I'm going to go out to eat with you. And they'd say, we're going to go to a pool party. Okay, I'm going to go to a pool party with you. And the whole time I didn't make sense, and I just was a weirdo. But they kept accepting me and kept saying, come back. And if it wasn't for that, I absolutely would go back to my familiar habits. So eventually, I got to find a new sponsor just by happen chance. And because I wasn't working my steps with Mandy, so I had to find a new sponsor. And it was the same exact thing, just a different person. So sponsorship shopping doesn't always work for me. But she said, we worked the steps, and when we hit 4 and 5, that was huge. It was such a big event. I got to really just share with somebody else really the depths of who I am. And I still work 4 and 5. I feel like even though I've worked my steps, and even though 10 is 4 and 5 again, for me 4 and 5 is a little different. For me 4 and 5 is suiting up and showing up every single day and showing people exactly who I am, and then sharing that with somebody else. So I get to do that on a daily basis. I'm always figuring out more of who I am, and then showing that to my community, and not putting on that mask. And then I got to work 6 and 7. This is a slow process too. There's like years between this. It wasn't like all in 1 week. But 6 and 7 was really, really weird for me. I got to figure out. I got to figure out just where so many of my mistakes were. And so many of my mistakes were just looking to have more prestige, more property, more absolutely everything, more ego to make myself feel better, that I was more than my fair share, okay? But that didn't happen until I worked 6 and 7. Before that, I thought my whole life that everyone was just an asshole. So I really got to figure that out. And then the biggest step for me, which I worked recently, was step 8 and 9. And step 8 for me, because at this point I've worked step 7, right? I'm in community, I have friends. So I think I'm pretty good, right? Like, I should start sponsoring, share them what Elle has. You know, Elle has a lot to give. if you want to put me on your pedestal and have me be your higher power, that's okay. You know, you got to do what you got to do, right? So, but luckily my sponsor called bullshit on that and didn't go with that. So I got to work step 8, and I really got to figure out where I owed amends to people, what I did wrong, and what I didn't do wrong. And up until this point, this has been 2 years, I really thought I owed the world amends just for being alive. I thought I was such a shitty person that on my amends list I put the internet for downloading. Like, oh, I'm sorry, internet. I put absolutely everyone, and I think that's just how it goes. You either put nobody or you put everybody. And that's, again, when that amazing tool of having a sponsor came in, and she told me, this is ridiculous, and you need to work on some self-esteem. You don't know those douchebags and amends. But do a living amends. And then, like a good sponsor, I didn't stop there. I went straight to 9. And this has been, I'm currently in my 9 right now. And this has been an intense step. This has been what I say, what separates the boys from the men. I have expectations I put on people, so if I'm going to call you up, I have a bulletin list, and I'm really hoping you let me go through it. If you don't, and if you hang up the phone, I'm just not sure if I still want to make that amends. But again, this is you know, this isn't how Elle sees it. This is what people have done before me. This is how the program works. So I just do it. So I'm going through this amends right now, and it's definitely interesting. Some people absolutely don't want to hear it, and that's okay, because it's not about them. It's about me clearing up my wreckage and being, for the first time in my life, the woman that I want to be. And some people are, like, on the phone for, like, 25 minutes giving me advice. I'm like, okay, again, that's not what I want, but that's okay. And step 10, right after step 9, step 10 is a phenomenal step 2. Every single day, even tonight, even though I feel, I feel like a child telling their parents how to do this thing by standing up here with 2 years and by being so young, step 10 absolutely comes in and saves me every minute if I let it. And step 10 is progress, not perfection. I'm just doing this to the best of my ability at all times. And it's, multiple times a day I get to tell myself I'm just human and I'm allowed to make mistakes too. Step 11, I keep on with my conscious contact. My higher powers absolutely changed from when I got here. Before it was, this really intense Christian God. I have to be perfect. You have to be perfect. I have to be okay, but you guys have to be perfect. Absolutely. And it just changed, and I believe if your higher power doesn't change, then that's definitely something to be concerned about. My higher power has absolutely evolved. Most of you guys know, because a lot of us are from Visalia, I have a gigantic Hindu goddess on my arm, and that's totally okay, I've learned. I don't have to have a black and white conception. It's just however I want it to be. AA or NA, what keeps me from the DA? I stole that from Albert. And step 12, I'm slowly working on, because of the people who are with me during that first, up until now, from that first meeting to this first day, I get to carry the message. And in some ways, it was the coolest thing going on that 12-step call with Albert. That was my first 12-step call I went on about a year ago, and it was awesome. And now, me and a couple, I get to support my friends when they show up and share. And the young people in Visalia, we're starting a young people's group, and that's so cool to be a part of something and to actually be able to give back, because I was such a dope fiend, alcoholic under bridges, but I had nothing to give back. Nobody wanted me around. I was a train wreck. And that's just so cool. And I get to carry the principles with me, and I get to just, every day I get to grow and change. And I feel bad that I didn't touch on what a mess I was. I mean, I kind of did, but if you guys really have questions, our whole group's here, they'll tell you. I was like a nasty mess. So I'm so grateful. I get to change and I get to grow and I get to have friends with me and just keep coming back, and suit up and show up. And now, it's been 2 years and I have a job and I've worked there for 2.5 years. I got to be district employee of the month, which if you ask me, I absolutely deserved it. Absolutely. Like, after 6 months, I was like, why aren't I manager yet? Like, what is this? And then that's God, doing for me what I can't do for myself, because that's inappropriate. And I'm just so blessed, and I'm so grateful I get to support Albert, who is absolutely one of the pivotal people in my recovery, who's got to I was blessed because he took me to meetings constantly, got to meet people in fellowship, and if it wasn't for people like Albert, if people were stuck up and self-righteous in here, there is no way I would be here right now, because my self-esteem when I came in was like a piece of glass, and it could have been shattered so easily. So I'm sorry. I'm really nervous and really tired. I hope I got it across to you guys. If not, I'm going to stick around and you're going to see me in a couple years and I'll do it again and try again. So thank you for being here, and I'm so excited. Without further ado, give it to Albert.
My name is Albert and I'm an alcoholic. I owe the group an amends. I haven't made my mistake yet, but I want to make my amends in advance. Because I'm probably going to say some things that might offend somebody in here. And I might not do the whole thing standing up, because I'm going to stand up as long as I can. And if I start to feel tired, then I got a cushion chair right here. And that cushion's starting to look good. But I got to tell you, man, I know I'm an alcoholic because I'm sitting here like an alcoholic. And where does an alcoholic sit? Right by the kegger, man. You know what I mean? And I'm over there looking at Tony's French fries, you know what I mean? And all this stuff's going on in my head, eh? And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Elle, man. I remember me how when she came into the fellowship, and I seen her struggle, eh? I seen her struggle, and she's right. She's right. You know, she said something that was very important, man, because, see, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't relate to a lot of people, man. And I didn't feel like I fit in. I felt out of place, but it was, the reason I'm sober is because there was people that were here when I got here that reached out to me. They reached out to me because my false pride and my ego would have never allowed me to reach out to them, eh? You know what I mean? And besides, they had all their teeth, I didn't. You know what I mean? And I wasn't hiding from the Cardassians, I was hiding from the Goodfellas, you know? So it's one of those things, man. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that the alcohol was just a symptom of the disease. It says many of us had problems way before we ever started drinking. And I was at a meeting last Tuesday. And you know how like you hear things all the time? And you've been hearing it as long as you've been sober? And then it's like 27 years later, somebody says it, and it's like you heard it for the first time. You know, I was with my friend Vertical, and he was telling me about, he had heard this song, The Man in the Mirror. And I'm like, how many times have you heard that song, eh? But it's like something happened that day that he heard it. It's like I had heard this song before, but I never heard it before. You know? And I remember when I started coming to the meetings, and I'm a newcomer, and I'm coming here to get my card signed, and I'm coming here so my parole officer doesn't violate me, right? And I'm listening to all these people, eh? And I'm listening to what they're saying, but I'm not hearing the thing they're saying, man. And then, you know how when you've been around a little while, you get a little bit of time under your belt, you get about 2 years, 3 years, and then you hear that noise? That sound of your head coming out of your butt, and then for the first time in your life, you're actually like hearing things that they've been saying the whole time you've been here. The symptom of the disease, man. The symptom of the disease. But what this girl said the other day, and she's a youngster, eh? And I heard her say this, and she said, but for the grace of God. I hear but for the grace of God almost in every meeting that I've ever been to in the past 27 years. And I heard it, I think it was Tuesday, man. The little youngster was celebrating 6 years, and she said it, but I guess it was the way she said it. Maybe it was something that I was going through. I don't know what it was. But I heard, you know, but for the grace of God. And I know what it is now. Because before I forget, I want to say happy birthday, first and foremost, to all the April people. And I also want to say happy anniversary. You know what an anniversary is, right? I want to say happy anniversary to me, my brother Bill right over there, and Danny and Mary. And I'm going to tell you why this is our anniversary. April the 8th of 1989 is my sobriety date. April the 8th of 2016, a year ago, I celebrated that I spoke that Wednesday at the Ice House in Visalia. And that was on a Wednesday. My sponsor, Rick, shows up and honors me with giving me my 26-year medallion, right? So that's on the 8th, and then Friday the 11th, 8th, 9th, 10th, okay? I come up here to speak because Mary had asked me to, and Danny, you know? And that day, I was standing up here, and I was in a lot of pain, eh? And You know, but I made a commitment. And I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, I was taught in the Lario, man, if you're going to say you're going to do something, you better do it, right? So I just applied that here, what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you commit to something, you know, then you made a commitment, right? Orale. So I made a commitment. And I was in a lot of pain that night. And my legs were hurting, eh? And it was on the 20th, right after that, on the 20th, think about that, 420. I'm not even a pothead, eh? But it was 420. It was April the 20th that they took both my legs. You know, and I got to tell you, I've said this before, and I will always say this because I firmly believe this, and what confirms my belief is my feelings. It doesn't matter what I think, eh? Because my thinking's all screwed up anyways, right? What I've learned, what matters is how I feel. And I gotta tell you, I feel in my heart that we are all God's kids. Hell said it. But sometimes I just can't help because you people make me feel like I'm his favorite. You know? Because it was a year ago, man, that they took my legs. And when that youngster Tuesday said, "But for the grace of God," it's only for the grace of God that I'm even here today, man. And if you're an alcoholic or an addict or both, then you know exactly what I'm telling you. I don't have to explain that to you. You already know. Because you probably questioned yourself, man. Dang, why am I even still alive, eh? It's because of the grace of God. It's only for the grace of God that I'm still here, eh? The big book says that the alcohol was just a symptom of the disease. You know, and that I had problems way before. I remember as a kid, and I'm not going to down anybody, but this is where I'm going to probably start offending some of you. I remember as a kid, man, growing up in the Lario, and this is a trip because we lived like right here in a cul-de-sac. My sister Lupi's here, so I got to be honest, right? My Aunt Julia, see, we lived right here. My mom was a barfly, my dad was a drunk and an abuser, eh? My tia, see, she's nodding her head, so when she stops nodding, I'm lying, eh? So, my tia Julia, who was my mom's sister, lived right there. And she was a barfly, and her husband took off, and she had two daughters, and she was bringing home all these messy pants winos from the bar, and my cousins were being molested. And I'm little. I don't even remember how old I was. And then over there, we had some other people that lived, and the Brianos and all these other people, and then there was drug dealers, eh? And then right in front of us were the Borks. Victor, he was like the oldest from Mayberry. You know what I mean? Victor was the town drunk. And he was also the town pervert, eh? He's the one guy that, he always rode around the neighborhood in his bicycle with his little basket full of booze, eh? You know what I mean? And he was drunk, getting kicked out of every place and molesting all the little girls in the neighborhood. And this is the neighborhood that I grew up in as a kid, right? So I'm tripping out on all this stuff. And then my Uncle Dario, he lives not too far down in another cul-de-sac, and he's dotting my Aunt Lucy's eyes every other day, man. You know, wearing sunglasses, you know, and it's not even summertime, eh? And to me, as a kid, I didn't know any other way of life. I didn't know that outside of that neighborhood where we lived, that there was another lifestyle, man. Because everybody, but this is where I tripped out on, eh? There was this one family that lived right here. They lived right here. Because our dirt road went like that, and we were here, and they were right there. And I'm out there on my big wheel in the driveway, you know, burning rubber or burning plastic. You know what I mean? And there's this family over there. There's this one family right over there, eh? And they're like, there's something wrong with them, eh? They're like a family, eh? You know, they go out there. They're like a Mexican version of the Brady Bunch, eh? They're like out there washing the car together like a family. You know, the big kids washing the top, the little ones doing the tires, eh? And these were the one people in the whole neighborhood that no one ever talked to. And I remember one day they were coming over to the house, man. And my mom said, come here, don't talk to them. They're a bunch of freaks. What are they? You know what I mean? And I grew up in a home where my dad was abusive. He played music in a band. And he wasn't always home. And he had another family somewhere else. You know what I mean? And I remember my brother a little bit because he's the oldest of the Garcias and I'm the youngest. But he was locked up a lot. And then I remember my sister who used to get in a lot of trouble. I don't really remember the details because, again, I was little. I was the baby. Okay? And cops were coming over to our house. And then my sister got in a fight with somebody, and I don't know what happened, and all this stuff going on, and my brother did something, and then the cops are coming over, kicking in doors, and all this crap's going on. And all these people, man, the cops are at my Aunt Julia's because she got beat up by somebody, or one of my cousins got molested, you know what I mean? And all this stuff's going on, or some drug dealers over here get raided, and there's cops, and it's like, normally. And then there's that one house that the cop, my whole childhood, I've never seen a cop at that house. And they were the freaks, see? They were the freaks. Don't talk to them. And I'm kicking back inside, and somebody's coming up to the house. And this is a trip, because I grew up in a neighborhood, and I grew up in a family that if gangbangers or troublemakers, what, you come outside, well, what do you want, man? You know, cops come over, what do you want? You ain't taking nobody. They're not here. Your mother, get out of here. These people would come to our house. My mom would say, shh, quiet. Quiet. Don't say nothing. They're going to hear you. And then if I looked like I was going to say something, and I'm like, you know what I mean? She goes, quiet, shut up. They'll go away. And I'm thinking, who are these people? I mean, we're not afraid of cops. We're not afraid of drug dealers. We're not afraid of drunks, belligerent drunks fighting. And then who are these people? They're Jehovah's Witnesses. Orale! They were the one family in the whole neighborhood. My family said, don't talk to them. They're freaks. Don't open the door. Quiet. They'll go away. And that's the one family in the whole neighborhood that they never, ever had a cop at their house, eh? And the neighborhood feared them, eh? Because they were higher power. My family talked about church, but we never went to it unless somebody died or got married. You know? I guess we were Catholics because my mom had all these statues and all these candles and never burned the house down. You know what I mean? So I guess that made us Catholics. I don't know, eh? I don't know. But my understanding of a higher power was twisted. And I'm not blaming anybody and I'm not downing anybody. This is just the symptom of my disease, was my upbringing. You know, my family grew up in this system. I think the only one that never did any time or got in trouble was Annette. You know, she lived with my grandma Florence. Called her Grandma Halfman because she smoked non-filters, man, and had tattoos and stuff like that, and she was rugged. And she used to drive her 58 Chevy with my Grandpa Leonard on the hood of the car, right? And she didn't take no crap from nobody, man. And that's why they called her Grandma Halfman, because she was more rugged than dudes were scared of her. You know what I mean? See, this is not in her head. I'm not lying, eh? I gotta tell you, man. Thank God that Annette lived with my grandma because the rest of us grew up in the system. I mean, we've been locked up, in and out, foster homes. You know that rabbit blood, you know what I mean? I never got to go to a fire camp because I had rabbit blood in my veins. And all these people got to shoot out to these fire camps and they got to do that stuff and I wasn't allowed. Because that rabbit blood, you know, they say, well, this guy goes to fire camp, he's going to jam. It's stupid me, probably would have, you know what I mean? Oh, I'm in fire camp, look, there's no gates here, no gun tower. I'm gone like a chicken through the cornfield, right? Because as a kid, we were taught, you know, to run away. But I never ran away from danger, trouble, or stupidity. I always ran away from foster parents, the social worker, the police, stuff like that. And those are the people that probably would have helped me if I had given them a chance, eh? You know, but I was raised to run away, you know. I remember my last drunk. I'll never forget my last drunk. They told me not to forget your last drunk. April the 7th of 89 was my last drink. I don't want to say my last drunk because I still was filling it on the 8th. But the 8th of April of 89 was the first day that I hadn't drank since. And I remember the 7th because I had paroled from Susanville on the 4th of July. And I remember one of my homegirls comes by and she says, hey, Columbo, my brother Eddie's getting out, man. I says, cool. And she goes, yeah, but nobody wants to go get him, eh? My mom doesn't want to go get him. She doesn't want to let us go get him because he's not coming home, right? So I ask her, where's he paroling from, me? And she tells me. And in my mind, being that righteous homeboy that I am, growing up and taught the way I was taught, I'm thinking, oh, well, Vivato's going to have some $200 gate money and some change. I'm going to do the right thing and go pick him up, right? So I did, eh? I drove to pick him up, shot him straight to the barrio. We went to the Rubalcava store, got some Thunderbird, and then went across the street and scored, eh? And when we were leaving the barrio, we come to this intersection, right? And this intersection, it's a four-way stop, man. And I remember the driver's test was like the only test I had ever passed in my whole life, eh? Any other test, I mean, come on, I didn't even finish continuation school, right? So that was like the only test that I ever passed in my whole life, and I only missed one. And I was proud of that. You know what I mean? And I remember the driving test, it says that when you come to a four-way stop, and if two cars come to the four-way stop at the same time, you know, the car on the right automatically has the right-of-way, right? So I remembered that. And I come to this four-way stop, we're leaving Cutler, we're going to go the back way to Dinuba, and we come to this four-way stop, and there's this car right there, man. And I remember I went to the car, and I said, go ahead, man. And he looks over at me and he says, no, you go ahead. And I'm thinking, no, because I know the driver's test. You have the right of way, you go ahead, right? He says, no, I insist, you go ahead. And I'm like, no, that's all right, you go ahead. And I'm going to tell you how smart I'm not, eh? This cop gets on the bullhorn and real loud, he says, go ahead, man. And I panicked, eh? I peed all over myself, man. I panicked. I was like this. And I took off, man. And as soon as I took off, he pulls up right behind me and throws the light. And you know, I'm thinking, that's stupid. He's right there. I'm right here. Why didn't I just make a right turn, eh? But after the fact, there's always no good. You know, you can always think about what you could have, should have, would have done, right? But it's already too late, man. You know what I mean? So when I made my turn, that cop pulled me over. And laws were stricter back then. Heck, you can get violated just for being with another parolee, man. You know what I mean? So here we are, two parolees together, hanging out, fresh needle marks, booze on our breath, drunk, you know, no license. We're just all the way wrong. The only thing we had done was we didn't commit any felonies. You know what I mean? And I remember they took us in, man. You know? And I'll never forget that because, you know, when you get locked up and you get sent away and you get to do some state time every now and then, and then you come back to the county, it's like all the cops that were out on patrol back then are now working in the main jail. All the main jail cops, the ones that know you, are now out on patrol. So I go back to the jail, man, and ain't nobody there knows me, man, because I didn't know any of them. That's how I knew they didn't know me. I go, who's this cop? Is he new or what? No, man, it's the years. Where have you been, man? They're rotating them. Orale. So I go in there to the jail, and you know, they got these little booking sheets, man, that they have you fill out. They got these little questionnaires. And these questions are like, have you ever been arrested before? No. Have you ever been convicted of a felony? Of course not. You know what I mean? Come on. You know what I mean? And they got all that stuff, man. So, because they just decided, because it was just a DUI, well, we'll just cite this dude out, man. We'll cite him out, and then he can go to court and then deal with it, right? And then I'm walking up the ramp, and I'm thinking, dang, man, I skated, eh? But something happened. I felt weird. And for the first time being released from jail, I felt that that's not right. So Monday, I went to the parole office, and I told my PO what had happened, eh? That was another thing that I had never, ever done before. I've never told on myself. I would lie to the grave, man. I never told on myself, eh? And I went, and I told on myself. And my parole officer says, well, Albert, I don't know what to tell you, man. Either you're scared or you're stupid. I said, I'm both, eh? Right now, I feel like both. She goes, I'm glad you told me, though. She goes, because you told me, I already knew. Your file's right there. I knew right when you got booked, man. They notify us. After they release you, they realize they messed up. You were on parole. You had a parole hold. They should have kept you, man. They screwed up. They let you go. But they caught it after they let you go, and they right away let us know. So I'm glad you came in, because you saved me the trip to Cutler. She said, because you were honest, I'm going to do something for you, man. She goes, I'm going to give you a chance to do something right. You've already done one thing right. This is the first time since I've known you. And this parole officer was my brother's parole officer. So everything she had to go through with my brother, it didn't make it easy for me either. You know what I mean? And she says, you got a problem. And it's alcohol and drug related. She goes, so if you can get some help, then I'm not going to violate your parole, man. I want to see you in a treatment program. I said, orale, I can do that. So she gave me this card and told me to start going to these meetings, eh? So I started going to these meetings in Dinuba on Thursday night. And I met some old guy. His name is Dennis Ehoff. The old timers know him. He's from Dinuba. He passed away. Dennis Ehoff, and he used to take me to meetings, and then he would take me to Reedley and introduce me to people like Robert Buckley, and then he would take me to Selma to the Messy Pants Wino meeting where I met Felipe, who used to be a Messy Pants Wino. See, Louis laughing back there. He knows who I'm talking about. You see, and I got to go to all these meetings in my early recovery, and I was coming to the Alano Club like every Friday, man, for my first few years, and Eddie was DJing back then. And all these people were here, you know, Tomas and everybody, and Tony and Cricket and Irene and all these people that were here back in the day, you know, and I had the privilege of meeting all these people, and they were doing it, man. And I saw what they were doing, and I wanted what they had, eh? You know, and then I told Dennis that what my parole officer told me. So he reached in his pocket, and he pulled out a handful of change, eh? This is before cell phones, eh? You know what I mean? I think back then, I don't even think they had pagers then. Unless you were a doctor or a drug dealer, huh? But anyways, so he reached in his pocket and he pulls out this handful of change. He says, I know this wonderful place in Visalia called Pine Recovery. I went through there. Call them. Here's the number. And I'm thinking, I don't want to call these people, man. That's messed up. They don't want to go to a treatment program. Because I forgot, you know, my parole officer was telling me, if you can get them to program, I won't violate you. So I'm thinking, how long is the program? He goes, it's a 60-day program. I'm thinking, dang, that's sweet, because my violation is 90 days. I'd rather take the 60 days than the 90 days, right? So I called Pine and all that stuff. Anyways, I end up getting into the program, and I'm going to these meetings, and I'm meeting all these people. And as a youngster growing up in the Barrio, I'm hearing this whole new language that I had never heard before, man. These people are talking like, man, where are these people from, eh? Serenity. I don't even know what that means, eh? Do you know what I mean? And then they're talking about this character that I was told was the freak, eh? They're talking about God, eh? And that God couldn't would if he were sought, you know? And God grant me the serenity. God, I offer myself to thee. All these things that we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what I mean? To do with me as thou wilt. All this stuff, and I'm here and I'm thinking, oh man, this is a trippy program, eh? So then, I remember somebody said, if you want to stay sober, Albert, then you need to do three things, eh? You need to do three things if you want to stay sober. He says, one, you need to get a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two, you need to be, no wait, he said, one, you need to be willing to go to any lengths for your sobriety. Two, you need to get a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Three, you need to read the first 164 pages. So do those three things and you'll stay sober. So when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm listening to what these people are telling me to do, so one, I was willing to go to any lengths for my sobriety. So two, I stole a big book. You see? Right there, eh? And I thought, well, shit, if I'm going to snag a big book, I might as well snag a 12 and 12 while I'm at it, right? That's like, why go in and snag, you know, do a beer run and not grab a carton of smokes at the same time? That makes no sense. So I got my beer and my carton right here, man. You know what I mean? So I go in and I do that. And I'm reading the book and it talks about a group of people that ordinarily wouldn't mix. You know what I mean? And then it says that the alcohol was just a symptom. And then they said, check this out, eh? Read the first 164 pages. When I was new, man, and I came in and I'm reading the first three pages were boring, I said, screw that, and I went to the back. Right away, and I started reading the stories in the back of the book. So instead of reading the first 164 pages, I went to 165 and started reading from there. And I look back 27 years later, and I'm glad I did, because the stories, see, this is a third edition. You see, in the stories here, they interest me. And then I get to this one story in the book and trip out on this, eh? I'm thinking, this is a story about a five-time loser who wins. Now, how do you become, how are you a loser and win, eh? And this five-time loser wins because he says, for me, as for most alcoholics, it was eat, drink, and be merry. For tomorrow you die. But of course, I couldn't die. I painfully awakened each time mentally, physically, and spiritually sick. Nothing could pull me out of the abyss but more alcohol. Check this out. Later on, it took alcohol fortified with other chemicals, fortified with other drugs to pull me up. Still later, even alcohol and chemicals together could not lift me. And some of you know what those other chemicals are, right? I don't have to mention it. It's an AA meeting, right? It says, we always are nearly... Check this out. It says, we always are nearly always had good intentions. When we were released from prison, but with that first drink, our good intentions dissolved. Our personalities changed. We reverted to the old way of life we knew. A life, bless you, a life full of anger, vindictiveness, resentment, fear, dependence, denial, self-will, irresponsibility, and we found ourselves back in prison, where our personalities became even more warped. Sobriety and a plan for living that produces a personality change in spiritual awakening are imperative. Through AA, many receive the needed change and awakening just by trying to live by the AA principles and associating with AA people. We do this by going to many AA meetings with an open mind and a desire to live the good feeling life without chemicals, liquid, or otherwise. Through AA, we can experience freedom. It doesn't say release date, it says freedom from self. After all, it was self, meaning me, that stood in my way, that ran the show and ran myself into bankruptcy. The hurt that hurt the one I loved. The 12 steps of AA are designed to kill the old self, deflate the old ego, and build a new free self. And then it ends with this. I am still arrogant. And those of you that know me probably think that's true. It says, I am still arrogant, egocentric, self-righteous, with no humility, even phony at times. But I'm trying to be a better person. I'm trying to help my fellow man. Guess I'll never be a saint, but whatever I am, I want to be a sober and an AA. The word alcoholic does not turn me off anymore. In fact, it is music to my ears when it applies to me. God bless all you people in AA, and especially you fellows in prison. Now you have a choice. I didn't know I had a choice, eh? I didn't know I had a choice. Alcoholics Anonymous, man, it changed my life, eh? All this time I had a choice and I didn't know it. And the reason why I related to this story, man, I remember when I was locked up. I was in Jamestown. I had the third highest paying job in the yard. I think I was getting like $47 a month. You know what I mean? And my job was, I used to go on the second tier right above the sergeant's office, and I used to make all the announcements on the 1 and 2 yard, right? And you know, so-and-so report, you know, to classification. So-and-so report to your job assignment. So-and-so whatever, eh? You know? And then I remember on Saturday, they had visiting, eh? So they gave me a list, and I used to flip on the microphone, the speakers kick on in the yard, and I start naming off the names of the people that God visits so they can start going to the visiting area, right? Then later on that day, when all the visiting's done, they clear out the visiting area and then they set it up. On Saturday they used to have H&I. And I didn't know what H&I was. Some of you do. I know Danny does. I know Tony and my cuñado do. You know, there's people in here that know all about hospitals and institutions. Either they've been in them or they still go to them. You know what I mean? But the bottom line is, these people from Alcoholics Anonymous were going out there taking these AA meetings out to these inmates. And then they had church there on Sundays, man. Me being that typical stupid alcoholic that I was, I used to go out there and make all the announcements. Hey, you know what? In the visiting area, they got AA meetings, man. And they might even have cookies. So grab your books and go snivel. You know what I mean? And then I would come out to the second tier, and I'm hanging out over the tier, and all these AA members that are walking to AA in prison, I'm over here laughing at them, eh? Shavallah. You know, PC, man. You know, and that's not politically correct. That's protective custody. Do you know what I mean? So I'm over here yelling PC and making fun of these guys, man, because they're going to AA. And see, again, the symptom of the disease, as a kid growing up, I grew up in an era, and some of you grew up before mine, I grew up in an era where TV at a certain time would go and it would go blank. Hey, there's people here that grew up probably when they had no TVs, man. But I grew up, and one of the last shows before the TV would go was Beretta. And I loved Robert Blake since Spanky and Our Gang, eh? You know what I mean? I've always loved Robert Blake. And Beretta was my favorite show. And the theme song from Beretta was, don't do the crime if you what? Exactly. If you can't do the time. Don't be out here trying to act all hard and trying to act all thuggish, and then you're going to roll it up when you get locked up, man. If you're going to pee on yourself in there, then don't try to act all hard out here, right? That like makes no sense at all, man. So I would see these guys in prison going to church, going to meetings, and I'm thinking, oh man, what a bunch of punks, eh? You know, they're out there trying to act all hard, and then they get in here and then they want to do this, eh? You know what I mean? And then later on, a couple of years later, I'm in Susanville, eh? I'm in Susanville. And I got a chrono, man. It says, Garcia, roll it up, man. You're going home like in 48 hours. What are they? You know, I can do this, man. You know, I'm getting ready to go home. Me and my homeboy Nano, we had been in the hole for a long time because some crap came down in the yard. And there was about, like, I think 32 of us that got sent to the hole. I was one of the 32, man. And we're there and we're cooking pruno and we're drinking and we're doing all this stuff, man. You know, and they tell me to roll it up. So I told Nano, I said, hey, I'm going to go home, man, in less than 48 hours, eh? So we tore open the bag, we filled up our tumblers, and we started downing this pruno. And we got drunk. And we got wasted. And if you've ever drank in pruno, you know what I'm talking about, right? We're getting drunk, we're getting belligerent, we're getting loud, eh? And Dean was the tier officer back then, so he walks up to the second tier in the hole where we're at, and he says, hey, man, you guys are getting kind of loud, man, you're going to have to hold it down in here, right? I go, what are you going to do, lock us up or what? You know? He says, oh, you think you're funny, huh? I said, no, man, your mother's funny. What are you going to do about it? He says, I'll show you, and he left. He took off, man. And the alcohol kicks in, I'm laughing, cell warrior, thinking, yeah, we showed him, eh? Dean came back with a goon squad, man. Goon squad with 7 CDC officers, man. And they're wearing hard hats, bulletproof vests, shields, they got clubs and steel-toe boots. Me and Nano are standing in a 2-man cell wearing boxers and shower shoes, man. I sobered up like that, eh? I sobered up quick. The bad thing was my homeboy Nano didn't. He didn't sober up. He said something stupid like, come on in, man. So they popped the door and came on in, eh? And here I was, 48 hours to the house, and I picked up another year, eh? And that's the kind of stuff I did out here. And that's the kind of stuff that I did in there. And you know the first thing that came to my mind? How stupid, eh? How stupid. You want to know the second thing that came to my mind? Those people that were in Jamestown that were going to AA meetings. And I'm hanging out over the tier, making fun of them, eh? Calling them names like Chavala, Sissy Lala, all that stuff, you know what I mean? Roll it up. Because, see, those people were locked up for a reason, just like me. The only difference between them and me is that they were trying to do something that might help them, but when they got out, they'd have a better chance of staying out. And I wasn't thinking like that because my mind wasn't programmed that way. You see what I mean? But for the grace of God, man, I end up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm introduced to people like you. You know? And you people that are doing this. And I know, and I'm not going to, don't take this wrong, I know that the newcomers, yes, they are the most important. But if it wasn't for you people that were here when I got here, you know, I wouldn't be here right now, eh? I wouldn't be here right now. Because I was the newcomer. I was the newcomer. But you carried the message to me, man. And you taught me that no matter what happens in my life, I don't have to drink or use no matter what if I chose not to. That, and you know what I heard somebody tell me? My first sponsor told me this, eh? And I started thinking of the freaks, eh? He said, you know what, Albert? He says, there's only one that can help you, and that's God. He says, but even He can't help you unless you're humble enough to ask Him. I didn't know what humility was. If I was humble, I would have asked, hey, can you spot me $4 and some change for a big book? But because I wasn't humble, I did what I knew to do and I stole one. I wasn't humble when I got here. And I wasn't honest when I got here. You see, and then they would talk about that old behavior. No, that wasn't old behavior. When I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous back in 89, that was the only behavior I knew, man. That's why I stole my big book and snagged a 12 and 12. Because that's what I knew to do. I never asked anybody, eh? This program has taught me humility. There's so many people in this room that have taught me so much. There's so many people in this room tonight that have been there for me. When that youngster was talking about before the grace of God, I'm going to tell you why it bothered me. Because in my mind I was thinking, I got all these wonderful people, man. Fresno, Porterville, and all these towns in between that love me. And they're coming to the hospital to see me. And they're encouraging me. And then they're sending their sponsees, man. There's this guy, Albert, over there. I need you to go take him to a meeting. And they're driving to pick me up to take me to meetings and take me back to the hospital. you know. And I started thinking, 27 years ago, there's not a person in this room, if they knew who I really was and knew what I really did, they probably wouldn't want to do a damn thing for me. And these people that I've had the privilege of meeting these past 27 years, these people that I've come to know, that understood me, loved me, accepted me, and tolerated me, have been there for me. My whole life I've been told, get the hell out of here. 27 years ago I walk into a room and these people are saying, keep coming back. I never heard that before. You people. That don't even sound cool, huh? You people. It's not a put down. It's a compliment. You people are the reasons that I'm still sober. You people are the reasons that I stayed sober. You know, since I've been sober, I've had 3 heart attacks. I've had a stroke, and I've had a 5 artery bypass. And I recently lost both my legs. And you know why I'm still sober? Not because I'm courageous. Not because I'm prideful. My whole life, I had lived in fear. Luffy knows. I've been scared my whole life since I was a little kid. But growing up, I learned how to mask that shit. I learned how to not show fear. What are you crying for, man? Come here. You want to cry? I'll give you something to cry about. I learned not to cry, eh? My whole life had been a lie. My whole life was nothing but a lie. Everything that I thought, everything I was taught, and everything that I had ever done, I had lived in fear my whole life. And you people taught me that it's okay to be afraid, because you can confront that fear and you can face that fear. You can face everything and recover. Or I could do what we've done our whole life, F everything and run. 27 years ago I decided I don't want to run no more. And now I couldn't run even if I wanted to. You know what I mean? But love you too, man. I came in here thinking that, you know, it had everything to do with my drinking. It had nothing to do with my drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous is not about what I did. You know, we've all done stupid, regretful things, eh? You know, we've all done things that, you know, like that saying, hey, if I can go back and do something different, would I? You're darn right. In a heartbeat. But I can't. Alcoholics Anonymous has nothing to do with what I did. But it had everything to do with why I did. Why do I keep doing these things that I know I don't want to do no more? Why do I keep hurting these people that I love? Why do I keep getting out just to go back? You know what I mean? Why? Why? You see, alcohol wasn't my problem. It was my solution, because once I would down that Thunderbird or a Schlitz the Bull or whatever it was, that Moe liquor, and I'd start downing that stuff, eh, I didn't care anymore. And then all of a sudden I get sober and I'm not drinking and I'm not using, and all these feelings that I had covered up for so many years are starting to come out, and I'm starting to feel all these things that I had never felt before. And it hurts and it scares me and I want to leave. But I know what will happen if I do, eh? If I leave, I'm going to go right back to Cutler, I'm going to go right back to the Vario, and I'm going to go boost Thunderbird at the Rubalcava store, and I'm going to be right back in prison again. I was scared to stay, but I was more scared because I knew what would happen if I left. That fear of leaving was greater than the fear of staying. And then in time I realized that I was safe here. I had never felt safe my whole life. I had never felt safe my whole life. I mean, jail's one thing, you know, correctional facility, anybody could do that. But when you end up in a penitentiary, you're in a whole different ballpark, eh? You know what I mean? And when you got to go take a dump and you got a mop wringer right there just in case you get rushed on the toilet, you know what I mean? That's a whole different environment. You know? I don't have to take a mop wringer with me when I go take a dump today, man. You know what I mean? I have a family, and I've always loved my family. But we never showed love in my family. We never did, eh? You know, I always thought, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. You know, I'm going to do this only because I love you, right? I thought that's what love was. I thought abuse was love, man. And then I come in here and I get sober, and then later on my sister gets sober. And we're hanging out, man, and we're doing all these things that we've never done before. And then as the years go by, man, my nephew gets sober. And we're doing things like a family should do, like the freaks did, eh? Now I'm the freak, eh? I'm the freak now, man. You know what I mean? And I'm proud of it. I'm proud of it. You know, they said something a long time ago. People, I go to meetings and all these people are hugging on each other, eh? And I'm like, what's up with these people, man? You know? And then they say, we love you. What a lit. You don't even know me, man. If you knew me, you wouldn't be saying that, right? And then I'd ask my sponsor, Dennis, and I'd ask him, why are all these people doing that? What's up with these people, man? They want to hug you, and then these guys want to hug you. And what's up with that? They got sugar in their tank or what, man? I don't get it. You know what I mean? So then he says, Albert, he says, we are going to love you until you can learn how to love yourself. And I'm like, how do you do that, eh? How do you love yourself? He goes, it's easy. You just got to look in the mirror and you got to tell yourself every single day, Albert, I love you. And I asked him, how long I got to do that? He says, until the day comes that when you do it, you actually believe it. I'll never forget my first year sober, I was in jail. Clearing up the wreckage of the past, all right? Let me make that clear. So I was my first year sober, I celebrated in jail. My mom shows up, my sister shows up. She's a resident at New Visions at the time. You know what I mean? My sponsor gives me a chip, the secretary gives me a chip. I got 3 chips on my first year sober, cake, punch, and like 32 members of Alcoholics Anonymous show up to celebrate my first year sober with me in jail. I didn't even get visits when I was locked up, man. You know what I mean? And now I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous and all these people are coming to visit me. And my mom is sitting next to me, eh? And she's crying. And right away she's crying and I'm thinking, oh shit, what'd I do wrong, eh? Why is she crying? And she said, I asked her, I said, hey lady, why are you crying, huh? And she says, because I'm proud of you. Because I love you. I've prayed for you your whole life. I read books, you know, when you're locked up, you run out of Louis L'Amour, so you gotta grab a romance novel every now and then. All you girls that get letters from guys in prison, no, that's not their words, man, that's them romance novels they've been reading. You know what I mean? And I have read about tears of joy. Yeah, right. That's what my mom had, eh? My mom had those tears of joy. I read about them. I had never experienced them. I never even witnessed them. My mom was crying because she was happy. And I remember, man, I went back to my cell, eh? And I go into my cell and I got this leftover cake and this card. Keep coming back. We love you. Oh, we knew you could do it. We love you. Hang in there. We love you. This too shall pass. We love you. All this love, man. And I'm, you know what I mean? And I get off my rack, eh? And I go up to that little piece of stainless steel on the wall that's supposed to be a mirror, but it's all carved up with so-and-so was here. You know what I mean? And I look in that little piece of stainless steel and I say to myself, Albert, I love you. And for the first time in my life, I knew what Dennis meant when he said, you're going to do that until one day you believe it. 1 year sober, I said to myself, I love you. I didn't feel conceited. I didn't feel stupid. And for the first time in my whole life, I was proud of myself and proud of the man that I was starting to become in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous with all my heart, eh? Always have, always will. My mom was not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom has 3 kids left. Before she left, she saw 2 of us get clean, huh? she saw two of us get straight. And she'd go to our alumni. And every year for 6 years, I would give my mom my medallion. You know what I mean? And she'd say, I'm not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I love your fellowship for what is done for my children. My kids are sober because of you. And then on my sixth year was the last year, I didn't know it then, was going to be the last chip I would ever give my mom. My first 6 years were her last years. And they were the best years I ever had. Those were the most exciting, unforgettable years of my life. And I'll never forget when my mom died. Loopy was there. I didn't make it on time. I'll never forget when my mom died. I went to her house and I stayed and I slept in her bed for 2 days. Because my mind said, that's the closest thing I'll have to my mom ever again. I'm never going to taste her menudo again. I'm never going to taste her chicken with nopales again. I'm never going to smell her again. So I slept in her bed for 2 days. 2 days later, I go home. And that light on the answering machine is blinking, So I hit the button and I got all these messages. Hey, mijo, we heard about your mom, If you need anything, call me. Hey, can we help you? Is there anything I can do? Give me a call. Hey, mijo, how are you doing? You know your mom was proud of you. Stay sober. Call me if you need anything. And I got all these phone calls. And the last message on my machine was my mom. I still have that little miniature cassette tape. My mom called me right before she died. And she said, mijo, it's your mom. And I have to go now. But I can't leave without telling you how much I love you and how proud of you I am. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. It saved my sister's life. It saved my nephew's life. And my mom died proud of us because of you people. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love you. Happy anniversary. Thank you for allowing me to come up here to share my experience, strength, and I don't know if I gave you any hope, but with you. God bless you, man.